You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. The Lion That Ruled 42nd Street. The Lion King has been a $9 billion smash hit, but it almost didn't get made. Michael Rydell tells the little-known origin story of Broadway's most unexpected blockbuster. Adapted from Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway by Michael Rydell, to be published in November by Avid Reader Press, a division of Simon & Schuster. Copyright 2020 by the author. Opening photo, It Took a Village. Cast, creators, and executives of the musical The Lion King, including Disney animation and theater heads Peter Schneider and Tom Schumacher, Samuel E. Wright as Mufasa, composer Elton John, lyricist Tim Rice, Jason Reyes as Simba, Disney chairman Michael Eisner, director Julie Taymor at the 1998 Tonys. Michael Eisner, the chairman of the Walt Disney Company, had no interest in bringing the Magic Kingdom to Broadway. Yes, he loved the theater. Growing up in New York City, he'd seen just about every Broadway musical from the time he was six until he went off to college. But when he was running Paramount Pictures in the early 1980s, the company had produced Tommy Tune's My One and Only, and, he would later say, it was the biggest nightmare of my life. Though the show was a hit, Eisner reflected, it took more time than anything I was doing at Paramount. I decided never again. This is a hobby we can do without. And then Frank Rich, the influential New York Times critic and columnist, raved about Disney's animated version of Beauty and the Beast, writing that the movie had the best Broadway musical score of 1991. Eisner began to reconsider. He ran into Andrew Lloyd Webber at an event in North Carolina and began probing, Lloyd Webber recalled. The hundreds of millions of dollars Cats had made around the world impressed Eisner. Broadway, like the movies, had become a global business. But when Eisner proposed a stage version of Beauty and the Beast, nobody at Disney wanted to do it. Fine, Eisner said. I'm the CEO of the company, so I'll do it. To direct Beauty and the Beast, Eisner hired Robert Jess Roth, who staged a show Eisner had seen while sailing on the Queen Mary. The musical, estimated at $20 million at the time, likely the most expensive in Broadway history, opened at the Palace Theater. The critics dismissed it as a theme park show. The Broadway crowd snubbed it, too, giving the 1994 Tony for Best Musical to Stephen Sondheim's short-lived Passion. But the family audience flocked to it. It became a blockbuster. Around this time, Eisner's architect friend, Robert A.M. Stern, suggested the CEO get involved in the nascent redevelopment of Times Square. There was a movement afoot to try to clean up the so-called crossroads of the world, and Disney's support would give the plan a lift. Eisner ignored Stern. Then, at a charity event, he found himself seated next to Marion Sulzberger High School of the New York Times family. As chairwoman of the new 42nd Street, she was spearheading the revitalization of a key stretch of the iconic thoroughfare. She told Eisner about the new Amsterdam Theater, a once grand but now decrepit space, right on 42nd Street. Disney, she suggested, should acquire it. I ignored her too, Eisner said. But he was intrigued. On his way to see his son play hockey in New Jersey one spring morning in 1993, he decided to take a look at the theater. It was dark. It was raining inside, he said. Birds were flying around the interior, but it was amazing. Eisner looked past the decay and saw the remnants of the theater's former glory, the Art Nouveau details, the faded friezes depicting scenes from Shakespeare, the remains of an Irish marble fireplace in the lounge. At one point, he brought Frank Wells, the president of Disney, to look at the theater. Two hookers propositioned Wells on the sidewalk. Eisner met with Mayor Rudy Giuliani and told him Disney couldn't be on a street full of prostitutes, peep shows, and porn houses. "They'll be gone," Giuliani said. "Mr. Mayor, in all deference," Eisner said, "I come from New York, and I know you just can't move somebody out. They've got rights. There's the ACLU. It's very difficult." "Look me in the eyes," Giuliani said. "What do you mean?" "Just look me in the eyes." Eisner did. "They will be gone," the mayor said. "Okay, so I guess they'll be gone," Eisner said. Disney began talks with the city to take over and renovate the New Amsterdam. By the time negotiations finished, Eisner had a show in mind for the theater, The Lion King. Next photo, Magical Menagerie. Director Tamor, trained in experimental theater and puppetry, works on actor's mask in her Manhattan workshop. Jeffrey Katzenberg, then chairman of Walt Disney Studios, had come up with the idea for The Lion King, the movie. He was flying to Europe on a private plane with Peter Schneider, the head of Disney Animation, to promote The Little Mermaid. They were talking about what films to do next, and Katzenberg suggested a story, set in Africa, about the moment a boy becomes a man. Schneider thought the concept was thin, but since Katzenberg was his boss, he knew he had to come up with something. A narrative emerged about a lion cub having to take his father's place as king. The working title was King of the Jungle. "The B-team was working on it," said Schneider, "because it didn't have princesses, and everybody wanted princesses. The A-team was working on Aladdin." Tim Rice, the lyricist of Evita and Jesus Christ Superstar, was on the Disney lot toiling away on a Dolly Parton movie called Straight Talk. He'd hit a rough patch in his theater career after the failure of his Broadway musical Chess. "I was just hanging around Disney Studios and saying, 'Got another job for me? I really like to write songs. I'm quite good at that.'" Rice met with Schneider and his number two in animation, Thomas Schumacher. They told him about King of the Jungle and asked him if there was a composer he'd like to work with. "Elton John," Rice said. "I thought he had the great combination of great melodies with a rock feel, like Superstar and Evita. Of course, I was thinking only of me at that point, trying to salvage my career. I knew working with Elton couldn't hurt." The plot of King of the Jungle was still vague, though it was beginning to resemble Hamlet. Hamlet with fur, as Rice called it. He and John took a stab at two songs, Can You Feel the Love Tonight and Be Prepared, for Scar, the evil lion who plots against his brother to take over the kingdom. John was often busy touring or recording, so he and Rice had to work remotely. Rice would write the lyrics, peck out his own little tune on the piano to make sure they sang, and then fax them to John. "I got quite attached to my little tunes," Rice said. "My Can You Feel the Love Tonight was like Tammy Wynette. And then a cassette would arrive, and there was Elton singing my words with a completely different tune. And I thought, that's not as good as mine. And then after two verses, I thought, it's a lot better than mine." When Katzenberg heard a tape of John singing Can You Feel the Love Tonight and Be Prepared, he was unimpressed. The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast had Broadway-style scores by Alan Menken and Howard Ashman. Can You Feel the Love Tonight was a pop ballad. Be Prepared had a tinge of rock. "We were not writing in the tradition of Alan and Howard," Rice said, so he got Leah Salonga, a Broadway star from Miss Saigon, to record a demo of Can You Feel the Love Tonight. and Rice himself performed Be Prepared for Katzenberg, Schneider, and other executives, putting it over as a theatrical song for the villain. This time, the songs worked. Next, Rice and John wrote an opening number, a bouncy ditty that listed all the animals in the jungle. Don Hahn, one of the producers of the movie, rejected it. "We've got to have something to really open the film, but big," he said. Rice found a line in the script. "It's the circle of life." "Good title," he thought. He began crafting a lyric that was more serious, a little philosophical. He and John happened to be in London at the same time, so they got together. John was at the piano playing around with rhythms. Rice fed him lines. "From the day we arrive on the planet. Band of Hope. Wheel of Fortune." While John developed a melody, he hit a crescendo and said, "Can I have one more line?" "On the path unwinding," Rice called out. "Don't know where that came from," Rice said years later, "but it's nice." They finished Circle of Life in about an hour and a half. Disney executives liked the song, but Schneider and others realized the show had to have an authentic African sound. Somebody, nobody's sure who anymore, thought of film composer Hans Zimmer, who had used an African choir and instruments in his score for a movie set in South Africa called The Power of One. Zimmer listened to Circle of Life and decided to play around with it for a couple of days. In his studio, he teamed up with Lebo M., a singer and a songwriter from South Africa, who once worked as a parking attendant in Los Angeles. The vocalist added some Zulu intonations and phrases, including "Nats Ingoyama Bagithi Baba." "The minute we heard it," said Schneider, "we all knew it was perfect." The Disney marketing machine wasn't so sure. The movie was now called The Lion King. It was about animals. There were no people in it. And the lead character, Simba, was male. The lead characters in a Disney movie were usually girls, preferably princesses. "It was still the B-team movie," said Schneider. The Disney equivalent of a Broadway out-of-town tryout is a screening, usually in an L.A. suburb, several weeks before a picture's release. Disney screened The Lion King for a family audience in Woodland Hills one afternoon, and then added a second screening for the date night crowd. "All these 18-year-old guys came in, hanging all over their girlfriends," Schneider recalled, "and we thought, what the F are we doing?" At the end of Circle of Life, the teenagers stood up and cheered, and that was the first moment we knew we had a huge hit on our hands, Schneider said. In the early 1980s, the celebrated Disney Animation Department, birthplace of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Dumbo, Pinocchio, and Fantasia, was a shadow of its former self. The Black Cauldron, released in 1985, cost $40 million and was a critical and box office dud. The Walt Disney Company was worried about takeover bids, but that year, Roy E. Disney, Walt's nephew, wrested control, and he decided to bring in Michael Eisner to salvage the business. Eisner wasn't much interested in animation. The big money was in live-action movies and theme parks. But Roy Disney was. He took over animation, and at a friend's suggestion, brought in Peter Schneider. A few years later, Schneider hired Thomas Schumacher. They made a good team. The high-strung Schneider had a temper, especially if he hadn't eaten. Underlings called his eruptions three veiners because of the blood vessels that stood out on his forehead when he yelled. Schumacher, always dapperly dressed with a neatly trimmed mustache and designer glasses, smoothed things over with wit and charm. He could sense a three-veiner coming on, and according to one Disney insider, knew how to head it off with food. Schneider and Schumacher, theater veterans, made new kinds of animated films. They had riveting story arcs, dizzying wit, and characters that evolved along with the plot. They began to produce one critical and box office smash after another: The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King. Then tragedy struck on Easter 1994. Disney President Frank Wells, flying home from a ski trip in a helicopter, crashed in the mountains of Nevada. Disney was thrown into turmoil. Jeffrey Katzenberg assumed he'd take over Wells' role, but Eisner, instead, shouldered the responsibilities himself. Furious, Katzenberg left the company a few months later to form the film studio and production startup DreamWorks with Steven Spielberg and David Geffen. As the corporate intrigue swirled, Eisner, ever mindful that a competitor might poach two of his most valuable employees, asked Schneider and Schumacher to assume control of Disney's theater division too, which was suddenly on the rise thanks to the success of Beauty and the Beast. "I always thought that Michael did that to keep Peter and me excited," said Schumacher, "to keep us in the boat at a time when the boat might be coming apart." Their first project was supposed to be a stage version of Aida with a score by Elton John and Tim Rice. But Joe Roth, who had replaced Katzenberg as head of the movie studio, had another idea. Walking across the Disney lot one afternoon with Eisner, he said, "Why aren't you doing The Lion King? How can it miss?" But when Eisner proposed a Lion King stage musical, Schumacher said, "Michael, that's a terrible idea." Beauty and the Beast had been conceived as a musical. The Lion King, Schumacher thought, was more of a film with a few songs and a haunting score. But Eisner kept pushing. One thing he was adamant about: The Lion King had to be different from Beauty and the Beast. He knew if Disney produced another theme park show, we'd be killed. He wanted something a little more adventurous. Schneider and Schumacher agreed. For two theater people who admired the work of artists such as Peter Brook and Pina Bausch, Beauty and the Beast was too literal a rendering of the movie. It was tame and predictable. They went back to their offices to hatch a plan. Schumacher hit upon someone whose work had impressed him when he was running the Los Angeles Festival of the Arts. "Peter," he said, "I'm just going to call Julie Taymor." Born and raised in West Newton, a Tony suburb of Boston, Taymor joined the Boston Children's Theater when she was 10. She staged plays with family and neighborhood kids at her large house on Fairfax Street. She was drawn to experimental theater, and after traveling through Sri Lanka and India, Asian theater. She studied mime in Paris, and at Oberlin College, joined an experimental theater troupe led by Herbert Blau. Taymor embraced Blau's belief in ideographs, pared down, abstract forms of expression. An example: if Blau or Taymor were to stage Sweeney Todd, a victim sitting in the barber chair might pull a red handkerchief from his neck to indicate his throat had been cut. After college, Taymor, thin, beautiful, and brainy, traveled through the Far East and Eastern Europe, learning mask work, shadow puppetry, and Japanese bunraku, in which the puppeteer is in full view of the audience. Taymor lived in Indonesia for 4 years and established her own group, Theater Lo. Back in America, her career took off in experimental theater, which often featured puppets. Schumacher was especially impressed with her production of Stravinsky's Oedipus Rex, starring opera diva Jessie Norman. The singers wore sculpted masks on top of their heads. "You're not going to put a mask over Jessie Norman's face," Taymor said. The audience saw the performer's face and the mask at the same time. Duality, as Taymor called it. She demanded a lot from her actors and her audiences. When Lincoln Center Theater put on Juan Tarion, Taymor staged an intense but arrestingly beautiful production without an intermission. Tamer was directing Wagner's The Flying Dutchman in Los Angeles when Schumacher called about The Lion King. She had to admit she had not seen the cartoon. He sent her a video. "It was beautiful," she said, "and I was taken with the challenge of how to put it on stage. How was I going to stage the stampede of the wildebeest?" Schumacher also sent her Rhythm of the Pride Lands, a CD inspired by The Lion King, with songs by Zimmer, Le Boheme, and Mark Mancina. Tamer loved it. Eisner had never heard of Julie Tamer. "Peter and Tom told me she does puppetry and mask and blah, blah, blah," he said. "So I studied her stuff a little bit, and it sounded like a pretty good idea. Putting an artist on a very commercial idea is something I've believed in my whole life." Eisner checked out her show, Wahandarian, at Lincoln Center, with Schneider and Schumacher. 10 minutes into it, he turned to them and whispered, "I think we have the right person." Tamer made maquettes of her proposed Lion King menagerie and took them to Orlando to show Eisner. She put them on his desk and began moving them around. One was a three-wheeled contraption that, as it rotated, made 6 gazelles leap and fall as though running across the plain. Tamer explained to Eisner that the audience would see the puppeteer pushing the gazelle wheel across the stage. "If you understand this idea, you want me," she said. "This is what I do. If you don't want to see the puppeteers, you don't want me." "Fine," Eisner said. "We'll do it." Disney was taking a risk. Tamer had never worked in the commercial theater, but to play it safe, Disney made Tamer give periodic presentations to Eisner and other executives. If they did not like the direction she was going in, they could sever the relationship. Tamer had a few demands of her own. She liked John and Rice's songs, but insisted that Le Boheme join the team to fill out the score. Another caveat, "I thought women were missing gravely from the story. The lionesses are really the ones who go out and get the food and run the show. The big lions are sleeping all the time. I knew it still had to be the Lion King, but I wanted to develop Nala." Tamer called her friend Thuli Dumakudi, a South African vocalist, when getting a workshop together. "There's really no role for you because there's not really any adult women in it," Tamer told her. Dumakudi laughed. "There are never any parts for women," she said. A thought struck Tamer. Why not make Rafiki, the mandrel medicine man, female? Disney agreed. As Eisner put it, fine, you can do that. That's not really changing the story. It's a monkey, okay?" As Tamer studied the animated movie, she discovered a hole in the plot. After Simba thinks he caused his father's death, he runs away from the Pride Lands. Scar takes over and destroys the kingdom. Nala coaxes Simba to come back, fight Scar, and assume his rightful place as king. "But he doesn't go through enough of a trial to earn the mantle," Tamer said. So she came up with a new second act. Simba runs off into the desert and sees a city of lights, a Las Vegas Disneyland of the Sahara. The inhabitants are half-human, half-animal. Humanimals, Tamer called them. Simba falls in with some bad characters and descends into decadence. Nala, along with Simba's friends Timon, a meerkat, and Pumbaa, a warthog, save him. They convince him to return to the Pride Lands and confront Scar. Tamer explained her new second act to Schumacher, and his mouth hit the floor, she recalled. "Julie, here's the thing," he said. "That's a really interesting idea, but I want to expand the material that we have. I don't want to do your version, but if your version is really important to you, then I guess we're at the place where we don't do this together." Tamer considered his reaction and replied, no, it was just an idea." She went back to the original script, but began to play around with the notion of the humanimal. She wanted the audience to see the puppeteers as they manipulated their creatures. But what if she put the puppeteer, still visible, inside the puppet? A cheetah, for instance, with the front and back parts of the animal attached to the puppeteer, who manipulates the paws with rods. Or a life-size Timon puppet attached to the actor at the feet, the actor shadowing the puppet. Or an actor on four stilts with a neck and head sprouting from the top of his head, a giraffe. People always think Julie's designs came first, Schumacher said, but she focused on the plot and the character, and that really liberated the big design idea. Few of Taymor's team came from Broadway. Michael Curry, designer and builder of puppets, Richard Hudson from Zimbabwe and an operatic set designer, Garth Fragan, a Jamaican modern dance choreographer, and lighting designer Donald Holder, who had lit Juan Darien. Le Boheme continued to write new music, with Taymor pitching in to write the lyrics to Endless Night. Taymor put together a diverse cast, with a chorus of singers from South Africa, whom she planned to fold into the show as the landscape. At one point, they would wear boards of grass on their heads to symbolize the grasslands. At a studio on 27th Street, Taymor, Curry, and an army of designers sculpted mask headdresses out of clay and silicone rubber. The regal Mufasa, the demented Scar, the serene Sarabi. They were working around the clock in the summer of 1996 to prepare for the first reading and presentation of their designs to Eisner and the California crowd, as one person nicknamed them. Taymor displayed her creations at 890 Broadway, a hive of theatrical activity once owned by Broadway director Michael Bennett. The actors read through the script and demonstrated puppet techniques. Mario Cantone, a comedian, played Timon. He was very funny, but he upstaged the puppet, Taymor said. As the day wore on, the Disney team became more and more skeptical. One of the executives could not grasp the idea of a mask on top of an actor's head. Is the audience, he asked, going to look at the actor? Or are they going to look at that African-type headdress, whatever it is, up there? Do you know Bunraku? Taymor asked. He had no idea what she was talking about. Schumacher shot her a look that said, they're film people. Have you seen my work? Taymor persisted. Of course he had not, she said. So I just shut up at that point. Taymor had made some mistakes. The mask for Mufasa and Scar were too big, and they were white, because she hadn't painted them. She knew that when completed and properly lit, the audience would have no problem taking in the mask and the actor's face at the same time. But in a brightly lit rehearsal, in the middle of the day, with Disney executives sitting just a few feet away from the performers, her designs were a bust. Eisner and the other executives got into their SUVs, leaving Taymor, Schneider, and Schumacher sick to our stomachs at the curb, Schumacher recalled. Then Schneider turned to Taymor and said, "We failed you, Julie, because we put your stuff in a room where it couldn't be properly evaluated. We need to get this back in front of Michael." Taymor had a thought. "I'm not pushing the puppetry," she said. "There are different ways we could do this." She asked if she could present three versions of Timon, Scar, and Zazu. Disney could then decide which version it liked best. "Just give me a couple of weeks," she said. Her puppet workshop, as it was being called, was done at the New Amsterdam Theater for an audience of one. Eisner, seated in the 10th row, so he was not on top of the actors John Vickery, Scar, Jeff Hoyle, Zazu, and Max Casella, now playing Timon. First up was a traditional rendering of the animals. Vickery was in a lion costume that was sort of like cats, he said. Casella was in a meerkat outfit. Hoyle wore a beak and did not have the hornbill bird puppet on his head. Next came a hybrid of the animal costume and the puppetry, with Vickery wearing a half mask on his face. Finally, Taymor presented her original designs, the Scar headdress on top of Vickery's head, the Timon puppet attached to Casella, who shadowed it, Hoyle, with Zazu on his head. The mask, now in proper proportion, were painted. The actors were in costume and makeup, and Donald Holder did the lighting. When the presentation was finished, the house lights came up, and Taymor awaited the verdict. "I'm going with your original idea, Julie," Eisner said. "The bigger the risk, the bigger the payoff." At which point, Vickery decided to quit. The bulky headdress was giving him headaches. The electronics used to operate it worked less than 50% of the time, and as the headdress extended out over his head and neck, he said, "I was doing things the human body isn't supposed to do." He told Disney, "This is going to injure me." Disney threw enough money at him that he stayed, but his fear of injury was not unfounded. Taymor's puppets made extraordinary physical demands on the cast. Next photos, the main event. President and Mrs. Clinton join the cast after a performance. The musical's creative team on opening night, November 1997. Samuel E. Wright assumes the leonine role of Mufasa, father of Simba. Puppet designer Michael Curry and Taymor adjust an actor's avian headdress. Rehearsals began in May 1997. Everything was compartmentalized. The dancers worked with Fagin in one studio. The actors worked with their puppets in another. They had to learn in a few months what puppeteers in Indonesia and Japan spent lifetimes mastering. The cast rehearsed musical numbers in one room, dramatic scenes in another. New lyrics by Tim Rice were coming in by fax. It was as though armies were marching on several fronts, with Taymor, General Patton, some called her, in command of it all. She had the whole show mapped out in her head and always seemed to know what she wanted. A cardinal rule, never upstage the puppet. Sometimes you got the feeling she was directing the puppet and not you, Vickery said. But she was open to good ideas no matter whose they were. Kevin Cahoon, playing one of the hyenas, told her he thought his character was the runt of the litter. "He always gets the scraps," he said. "I wish we could see his ribs." "Great idea," Taymor said, and redesigned the costume. The actors were never quite sure what was going on, but there were moments when they realized the Lion King was reaching for and achieving artistry. When Fagin, who kept his dancers sequestered, first presented the lioness's dance to the whole company, Hoyle was knocked out. "It was so beautiful and very touching," he said. But the dance was so demanding, he wondered how the women would be able to do it 8 times a week. If you're in a modern dance company, maybe you do it 3 nights and then you take a break, he said. There were no breaks on the Lion King. "We were being pushed beyond the limits of the human body," Vickery said. Taymor spent a lot of time putting together Circle of Life. It was the opening number, and the staging had to capture the spirituality of the song. It begins with a sun rising over the Pride Lands. "I could do a sunrise with a projection," Taymor said, "but I made a commitment to doing theater at its most poetic, and that is often minimalist." She made her daybreak out of aluminum rods and pieces of silk. It was a pile on the ground, and then, as that incredible song happens, the audience sees the strings that make it rise, and I knew because of Don Holder's lighting and the natural air, it would do the shimmer, she said. It was impossible to see in the rehearsal studio what Taymor saw in her mind's eye. There were no lighting effects. The actors playing the giraffes couldn't wear their long neck headdresses because the ceiling was too low, and Pride Rock, designed by Richard Hudson, to spiral up from below the stage. Elevating Mufasa, Sarabi, and Baby Simba was still being built in the scene shop. As Taymor was hurtling toward previews, Eisner was getting ready to unveil his newly refurbished theater on 42nd Street. With tax breaks and subsidies, basically the New Amsterdam was given to us, he said. But now that Disney was coming to Times Square, other companies were as well, including AMC, the movie chain, Condé Nast, publisher of Vanity Fair, and Madame Tussaud. And directly across the street from the New Amsterdam, Canadian impresario Garth Drabinsky was building a theater for his long-awaited Ragtime, a new musical based on E.L. Doctorow's best-selling novel. Like The Lion King, Ragtime was a musical extravaganza, though far more traditional in concept and design than what Tamor was creating. Meanwhile, Giuliani had deployed tough zoning laws and hard-nosed policing to get rid of most of the peep shows, drug dealers, hookers, and muggers. In June, the Lion King troupe decamped to Minneapolis to prepare for its first public performance on July 8th. So began one of the most grueling technical rehearsals in American theater history. Tamor was a perfectionist, spending an entire day, for example, teaching a scene that lasted 5 minutes. On the first day of rehearsals, Tamor fell ill. It turned out to be her gallbladder. It was removed, but she was back at the Orpheum the next day. She directed while reclining on a bark-a-lounger. The crew dubbed it the bark-a-lounger because she'd bark instructions from it over a microphone. Much of Tamor's work was simple and poetic. A large piece of blue silk pulled through a hole in the stage symbolized a drought. Mourning the death of Mufasa, the lionesses pulled long pieces of white crepe paper from their eyes, from the eyes of their mask, to connote tears. But the production had some enormous sets, including Pride Rock and an elephant graveyard, both of which spiraled from beneath the stage. Tamor had solved the problem of staging a wildebeest stampede by creating a series of giant rollers with wildebeest attached to them. The contraption weighed more than a ton, and sometimes the wildebeest would fly off. The backstage choreography was as intricate as it was under the Klieg lights. If you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, you might get killed, one actor groused. Stage managers told Tamor there were so many costume changes in the first act that it was chaos behind the scenes. They urged her to come back and take a look. "I don't think I should," she said, "because then I'll feel bad. You guys work it out." Performers got injured. Some dancers called the show's love duet, "Can You Feel the Pain Tonight?" Disney employed physical therapists to massage sore backs and muscles. The four stilts in one of the giraffe puppets gave out one day, and the actor went splat, said Vickery. "For a few seconds, we thought he was dead." Tempers flared. On another occasion, Vickery got stranded in a stage-side elevator for 2 hours, and once extracted, exploded at Tamor. Hovering over it all were Schneider and Schumacher. As noted earlier, Schneider sometimes lost his cool if he didn't eat. "Eat meat, Pete," people would tell him. Schumacher, the great schmoozer, as Eisner called him, made jokes to diffuse tense situations. They had worries of their own, though. The Lion King wasn't drawing as well as they'd hoped. It went on sale in New York that spring and promptly took in $5 million. But in the summer, sales tapered off, and they were not great in Minneapolis. The July 8th preview was only half sold. They thought about canceling it. They still had not run the show from start to finish, but they steeled themselves and went ahead with the first public performance. The house went dark. Then Sidi Leloka, as Rafiki, pierced the silence with a Zulu chant. She called out to two South African singers on the balcony. They called back. The orchestra began playing, slowly at first. Elton John's theme, as the giant sun, nothing but aluminum and silk, rose from the back of the stage. Two life-size giraffe puppets loped in from stage left. A cheetah puppet appeared from stage right, licking its paw. A bird woman fluttered across the stage, followed by three zebras, their heads attached to the puppeteer's chest, their hindquarters attached to the puppeteer's backs. Three dancers, holding gazelle puppets in both hands, with a third gazelle attached to their heads, leaped across the stage. The audience, stunned at the beauty of what they were seeing, began to cheer. Children stood on their parents' laps to take it all in. Then they whipped around to see a procession of animals, a rhinoceros, more bird ladies, a giant elephant followed by its baby, make its way down the aisles of the theater. The actor Kevin Cahoon, peering out from a slit in the elephant's leg, saw astounded looks on the faces of children and adults. People were clutching each other and pointing everywhere. Many people, he noticed, were wiping away tears. Pride Rock spiraled up from below the stage. Mufasa and Sarabi, holding baby Simba, climbed to the top. Rafiki joined them to bless the lion cub. As she hit the last note of the song, she held Simba high above her head for everyone to see. Blackout. And then came a roar from the audience, unlike anything the performers had ever heard in a theater. People were standing on their seats, cheering and applauding. At the back of the house, Tamor, Schumacher, and Schneider looked at one another and burst into tears. John Vickery was not in the opening number. He was in the next scene. When Circle of Life ended, he thought, "How the F am I going to follow this? It was like going on after the Beatles," he said. There were many other wonders along the way, from the grass heads to the lioness's dance, to Mufasa's giant face materializing from out of nowhere. The show may have been a bit long, but the audience didn't care. They would have stayed all night. By the second week, there wasn't a seat to be had. The Lion King was the biggest hit Minneapolis had ever seen. Back in New York, theater advertising executive Nancy Coyne and her creative director, Rick Elise, were honing a sophisticated ad campaign, pitching the musical not as another Disney spectacle for kids, but as an artistic triumph. It was meant to appeal, as Elise put it, to the cognoscenti, the tastemakers, the opinion makers, the people who wouldn't go to see Beauty and the Beast, but who will go to see Julie Taymor's brilliant artwork. Press agent Chris Bonneau was already working the cognoscenti. He gave Time exclusive access to the creative team during the Minneapolis tryout. The favorable article alerted Time's millions of readers that The Lion King was no Beauty and the Beast, and that Julie Taymor was a genius. The New York Daily News sent me to check out the show. With some time to kill, the night I arrived in Minneapolis, I wandered over to the Orpheum to eavesdrop. I walked to the back of the theater a few minutes after the show had started and heard a strange sound. It was a roar coming through the concrete wall. The next day, I took my seat in the orchestra. I'd heard the show was good, but I was skeptical. I didn't care for Beauty and the Beast, and while I admired Taymor, I couldn't see how she fit into the Magic Kingdom. Frankly, I was hoping disasters in the air, as Tim Rice wrote. At the end of Circle of Life, however, I, too, was on my feet, with 1,500 other audience members, whooping and applauding. After the show, I met Schneider, Schumacher, and Taymor. They asked what I thought. "I think you have the biggest hit on your hands since The Phantom of the Opera," I said. That October, The Lion King played its first preview at the New Amsterdam. Disney invited talk show host Rosie O'Donnell, an arbiter of the theater scene, to an early preview. She went back the next day with her 2-year-old son. On her TV program, she called it the best show she'd ever seen and urged her millions of viewers to get tickets before the reviews came out. That endorsement, along with the tremendous word of mouth racing round the city, drove the advance to nearly $20 million by November 13th, opening night. For the premiere, O'Donnell came yet again. Elton John, seeing a live performance for the first time, broke down at intermission and told friends that Princess Diana, killed that summer in a car crash in Paris, would have loved it. Director Francis Ford Coppola, standing on his seat, led the ovation for Tamor at the curtain call. Garth Drabinski, whose Ragtime was about to begin previews on the other side of 42nd Street, sat across the aisle from me that night. He joined the standing ovation, but I noticed the color had drained from his face. The following May, The Lion King picked up 11 Tony nominations to Ragtime's 13. Both were nominated for Best Musical. Drabinski's Tony strategy was simple: drive home the point that Ragtime, which had received mixed reviews from critics, was nonetheless an important new American musical. Tony voters may be impressed with Tamor's puppets, but surely they were not going to give the crown to a kiddie show. Schneider and Schumacher wanted the Tony for Best Musical, of course. It would validate Disney as an artistic force on Broadway. But they were realists, figuring they'd have to settle for Best Director for Tamor, along with a slew of design awards. Nonetheless, they spent weeks flying back and forth between L.A. and New York, attending press junkets and meet and greets, trying to put a human face on the Disney production. We lived on the corporate jet, Schumacher noted. We had our pajamas on the plane. Right before the Tony Awards, Disney threw a cocktail party at the Rainbow Room. Schneider and Schumacher came up to me and Newsday theater columnist Patrick Pacheco, another champion of The Lion King. "We're going to lose tonight, aren't we?" Schneider asked us through clenched teeth. "Yes," we said. "The Lion King is an artful spectacle, but the top prize will go to Ragtime because it's a traditional Broadway musical." The night of the Tonys, Michael Eisner didn't even bother attending. I went to the Beauty and the Beast one, and it was such a horrible experience. I didn't want to go through it again, he said. Shortly into the ceremony, O'Donnell introduced the opening number from Ragtime, calling the show a star-spangled blockbuster. The audience responded enthusiastically. As expected, The Lion King swept the design awards, and Tamor became the first woman to win Best Director of a Musical. Ragtime won for its book and score, and Audra McDonald won Best Featured Actress in a Musical. The Tonys, in the view of the theater press huddled in a bunker deep in Radio City Music Hall, were unfolding as they'd predicted. And then, the cast of The Lion King performed Circle of Life, and 6,000 people stood on their feet and cheered and cheered. "The Lion King," O'Donnell said when the number ended, "is the most astounding show I've ever seen in my life." The mood was shifting, but Schneider and Schumacher still had their doubts. They had a car waiting at the curb to whisk them away as soon as the telecast finished. During the final commercial break, O'Donnell told the audience, "Okay, guys, we're up against it. We only have a minute left. Nathan Lane, the presenter, is going to be in position. We're cutting his pre-thing. He's just going to say the nominees and then say who won. Whoever you are, say thank you. There's no time for a speech. Get off." The telecast resumed. Lane ran on stage, looked at his watch, and rattled off the nominees. "And the Best New Musical of 1998 is The Lion King." His eyebrows shot up so high they almost hit the roof of Radio City. Schneider and Schumacher raced down the aisle, Schumacher tripping on a cable. They squeezed in a short speech, then ran off stage and right into Isabel Stevenson, the head of the American Theater Wing and the Grande Dame of Broadway. She took them in her arms and said, "I voted for you boys." The show, in fact, would go on for nearly a generation, In March, The Lion King was in its 23rd straight year on Broadway before COVID-19 shut down all performances on the Great White Way. In New York City alone, the musical had grossed more than $1 billion. There had been more than 24 productions around the world. All told, the show had brought in nearly $9 billion, putting it on par with the Star Wars franchise and Grand Theft Auto. Eisner had it right when he told Taymor, "The bigger the risk, the bigger the payoff." Vanity Fair's Editor-in-Chief is Radhika Jones, Creative Director, Kira Pollack, Deputy Editor, Daniel Kyle, Executive Digital Director, Michael Hogan, Director of Editorial Operations, Karen Prime. Executive Editors, Claire Howarth, Matthew Lynch. Executive Hollywood Editor, Jeff Giles. Director of Special Projects, Sarah Marks. Executive Entertainment Director, Allison Ward Frank. Managing Editor for VF.com, Kelly Butler. Deputy Editor for VF.com, Katie Rich. Editor, Creative Development, David Friend. Senior West Coast Editor, Brett Hennemuth. Senior Editors, The Hive, Michael Calderon, Claire Lansbaum. Senior Hollywood Editor, Hilary Bosis. Senior Editor, Keziah Weir. Entertainment Editor, Caitlin Brody. Associate Editor, Aaron Vanderhoof. Senior Media Correspondent, Joe Pompeo. National Correspondent, Emily Jane Fox. Politics Correspondent, Bess Levin. National Political Reporter, Abigail Tracy. Chief Critic, Richard Lawson. Senior Feature Writer, Julie Miller. TV Correspondent, Joy Press. Senior Staff Writer, Joanna Robinson. TV Critic, Sonia Soraya. Staff Writers, Dan Adler, Kenzie Bryant, Johanna Desta. Staff Reporter, Caleb Ikarma. Special Correspondents, Nick Bilton, Anthony Bresnikan, Brian Burrow, William D. Cohen, Joe Hagan, Maureen Orth, Jessica Pressler, Mark Seal, and Gabriel Sherman. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.